Okay, Michael, thank you very much for joining us today to have a discussion about, you know, innovation, technological change, and what it means for the future of work. Together with your colleague, Carl Benedict Frey, you've published several studies that have made a big impact. First of all, can I ask you, when you write about the changing nature of innovation, what particular do you mean? What is changing?
Okay, so actually the developments about which I'm most excited have emerged from my own field, which is that of machine learning, which many of your listeners might know better by the name of artificial intelligence. So our idea is that developments in the field of, you know, machine learning accompanied with those in mobile robotics are really going to have quite a transformational impact upon human employment. So in particular, we point to the introduction of algorithms that are able to perform sophisticated, subtle decision-making in a way that was previously the reserve of humans, that are able to navigate the streets, that are able to make recommendations of products to customers. All of these things are, you know, very likely to substitute for human workers in the fairly near future. So our study set out to kind of put some numbers to this phenomenon. So in particular, we used a data set from the US in which we had 702 different occupational classes. And for each of those, we had kind of a list of characteristics of the job. So this organization in the US, ONET, had gone about determining the requirements for different types of skills within each of its different occupations. So these included things like persuasion, manual dexterity, originality, all characteristics that we thought might be predictive of a job's susceptibility to automation. And so on the basis of that data, we used, in fact, a machine learning algorithm. And the characteristics of jobs about which we were most confident were not going to be automated in the next 20 years, or in fact, we had already seen some evidence of being automated, to try and identify the characteristics of jobs that rendered them susceptible to automation, and thereby to predict for all jobs a probability of automation. And so, in particular, we arrived at this headline figure that 47% of current US employment might be at high risk of automation over the next 20 years.
Okay, and if you want to categorize, you know, in the international literature, there seems to be a tendency that the jobs that are less likely or the least likely to be substituted are ones based on creativity, even though there's a discussion about it, but also the ones in particular based on social capital and human interaction. Is this something you would also agree with?
We agree entirely with that characterization. So in our study, we highlighted three bottlenecks to computerization, as we called them, and they were exactly creativity, social intelligence, and perception or manipulation. So what unites those three bottlenecks is the kind of deep reservoirs of tacit knowledge that humans have about the task they're performing. So to give an example, consider the generation of a hit song, right? A kind of quintessentially creative task. So it's very easy to get an algorithm to churn out an endless stream of songs, but it's very difficult to teach the algorithm the difference between a hit song and not such a good song. Because in doing so as a human, we draw upon this kind of enormously sophisticated conception of our social environment and our cultural context in a way that's very difficult to explicitly state in code. So it's exactly those three characteristics of jobs that we think are most difficult to automate.
Okay, well, the German Labour Ministry recently commissioned a study that took a slightly different view on the automation potential. They had basically three main points of criticism of your methodology. And the first one would be that what you seem to be describing is more an impact of technology on activities rather than jobs themselves, and that the same jobs even might not perform the same activities. So there is a difference between the activity level and the actual job level. The second one is that the potential, if you estimate the potential, that you rely on too much about on expert opinion, which tends to overestimate the potential for substitution and rationalization. And the third aspect was that even though there might be this kind of technological potential, there are also social, legal, as well as ethical barriers to implementation, which would sort of mean that, you know, the full potential is not being achieved. So the figures they come up with is 9% in the US and 12% of the German jobs might be at risk for of automation. What is your response to that kind of approach?
Well, I might respond to the second of those criticisms first, because it's the only one with which I really disagree. So they highlight our use of expert opinion as a basis for our study, which is true, but I think more needs to be said about that. So the first point is that we weren't slavishly following the advice of the experts upon which we drew. So the way our algorithm worked, which is itself a quite sophisticated piece of machine learning, is that the advice of the experts, the labels they provided to 70 different occupations as being either automatable or not over the next 20 years, were treated as kind of noisy or untrustworthy estimates of what will actually happen in reality. So our algorithm is actually quite tolerant to mislabeled examples. To give one kind of example of that, in our training set, we'd included waiters and waitresses as an example of an occupation that was non-automatable. And I guess the thinking there was that the kind of small talk that a waiter or waitress makes in the process of performing their job is not something that's readily automated, that, it's very difficult to teach an algorithm all the kind of social nuances that a waiter or waitress might draw upon. Nonetheless, our algorithm had come back and told us that the probability of computerization for waiters and waitresses was 94%, which, struck us as quite high. But interestingly, in the time since we've published the study, so since 2013, we have actually seen restaurants, particularly in the US, automating some of the jobs that waiters and waitresses might have traditionally been asked to perform in placing tablets on tables in restaurants. So these tablets are able to take customers' orders, they're able to recommend products to them, and in fact, they're able to substantially increase dessert sales in particular by as much as 30% by providing customers with these enticing-looking images on the tablet. So the point... Sorry.
Go on.
So the point I was trying to make is that the algorithm we used wasn't completely subject to the biases that the experts we used provided us. It was able to correct, as I say, for some mistaken labels. And in particular, we performed some sensitivity analysis in which we subdivided the training set that we used. So in particular, we used a subset of 35 of the 70 occupations that we had labeled to try and predict the other 35. And we did this over many iterations of splitting that training set into two. And yet, regardless of the split that we made, we found that we were able to very accurately predict that held out half, given the half that we'd retained for the algorithm. So what this tells us is that, yes, it's possible that we're wrong entirely about what is automatable, but at least we're consistently wrong, that there doesn't seem to be a whole lot of inconsistency in this training set that was provided.
Okay, and what you say is basically that for some of the jobs, you were actually on the cautious side.
I think that's true, yeah. So for waiters and waitresses, as one characteristic example, we'd overestimated the influence of social intelligence. But what the algorithm picked up is that the low creativity score or originality score for waiters and waitresses does indeed render them quite susceptible to automation.
Okay. And what do you make of the argument that, the likely impact is not necessarily substitution only, but it's basically a changing phase of the job. So the job description itself will change and the human activity will basically be more augmenting technological capacity rather than sort of being in direct competition. Is this also something that you would subscribe to?
I'm very sympathetic to that point of view. I think that is indeed how automation takes root in the economy. So historically, of course, we saw people like the typing pool of the 1950s replaced by word processing software, despite the fact that it's not that, the word processing software was able to do everything that the typing pool was able to do. The job was kind of simplified to the point that it was able to be automated. So, the job of what that typing pool contained was essentially eliminated, despite all its characteristics not being automatable. But more broadly, there was a study recently from Australia which tried to put some numbers to this phenomenon by which the characteristics of a job might actually change over time, and in particular, how they might change in relation to automatability. So this study will be coming out of the Office of the Chief Economist in Australia and found that there has indeed been quite substantial changes within occupations as pertaining to their susceptibility to automation, even over the last 10 years. So I think that is a very substantial kind of effect. I'm not sure whether the real-world consequences will mean that occupations become either more or less automatable. I guess my first point was that, in fact, it's possible to simplify tasks, simplify jobs to the point that they are automatable, just as jobs are able to be rendered more complex to the point that they're not automated. And which of these will actually play out in the real world is still up for debate.
Mm-hmm. So we're basically talking about, when it comes to the impact of technology on jobs, on three levels. The first level would be what kind of jobs could be replaced by technology. The second one would be what kind of jobs will change, maybe even fundamentally, because of the impact of technology. And the third one would be job creation. What kind of jobs will be newly created as a result of technology? What would you say to the third point?
So again, a very important point, and we quite explicitly acknowledged in our original study that it did not consider the prospect for new job growth. However, in subsequent work, my co-author Carl Frey has indeed looked at what new jobs have emerged over the last decade within the US and finds quite alarmingly that the new industries that have been created now only contain about half of 1% of current US employment. So these new industries that have emerged haven't necessarily generated a whole host of new employment. And perhaps the most emblematic example is found in the tech sector, where a company like WhatsApp, for example, was bought out for $19 billion US at a point at which it had only 55 employees, which compares quite unfavorably against a business of kind of similar valuation, like the fashion retailer Gap, which has about 137,000 employees. So yes, there are new jobs created. It's not clear that there are as many of those new jobs as we might like. And it's also not clear that the jobs that are being created might be suitable for the people who are put out of work due to trends in technology. So if we look at the list of fastest growing occupations since the year 2000, they include jobs like data scientists, iOS developers, Android developers. I don't really think that there are going to be all that many people put out of work by, for example, self-driving vehicles. People like truck drivers who are able to move very naturally into these quite high-skilled occupations.
Mm-hmm. So we might also see basically a polarization of the labor market. I mean, when I discuss my own work on the impact of technology on work on at BBC Newsnight at the end of last year, Evan Davis, the presenter, said, "Well, but we haven't had so many nail bars around previously." So you might say that there is a polarization into high-end, high-skilled jobs, but also very low-skilled sort of personal service sector jobs.
I think that's absolutely right. And in fact, one bit of analysis we did in our original study was to try and plot the probability of computerization against two different measures of skill. So in particular, we considered how the probability of computerization might relate to the fraction of workers in any occupation who have at least a bachelor's degree, and also the average median wage in each of these occupations. And what we saw very clearly is that the probability of computerization was negatively correlated with these measures of skill. So simply put, the more skilled you are, the less susceptible you are to computerization, which does indeed suggest only a continuation of this polarization in the job market.
Well, and the trend that we've seen even before that, you know, these sort of low-skill but personalized service sector jobs, they're also very hard to replace with technology, aren't they?
That's right, but they're not necessarily going to be very highly paid, because as a result of them not requiring much skill, there's going to be a whole host of people who are willing to take on these jobs. And, you know, this, as I suggested, may only lead to an exasperation of the inequality we've seen develop over the last couple of years.
Exactly. I mean, what it basically means is that the middle-skilled jobs are going to be hollowed out. They're moving towards both ends, the very top and the very bottom.
I think that's correct.
Yeah. And you've just mentioned, actually, the next one I want to talk to you about is it's basically inequality. I mean, the main point of the paper that I wrote on the issue at the end of last year is that we are already back to inequality levels that show certain macroeconomic dysfunctionalities. I mean, you just have to go into Thomas Piketty's work, you know, to look at the fundamentals of this. But there is a likelihood with the unfolding impact of technology that these inequalities will get worse, at least in the short to medium term, and that we're going to see an exacerbation of inequality. Would you also see it that way?
I would indeed. And in fact, there is an excellent book that's just come out from Oxford economist Tony Atkinson, which puts even more weight behind this hypothesis. I think we need to, however, not lose sight of the fact that there will be enormous wealth generated by technological change. So, you know, it's clear that in the development of digital goods that have next to zero marginal cost, that innovation has enormous potential social good for all, at least when we consider people as consumers. But the risk, of course, is that due to these risks to people as workers, there will be developing inequality. So I think it's not necessarily a problem of wealth generation, it's a problem of distribution.
Well, fundamentally, yeah, it is. It is. It makes a distributional question that we already have even more pressing, in my view. So coming to the policy responses, I mean, I agree with everything you've said. And in terms of policy response, how should policymakers react to this or try to prepare for this? You know, I personally see three areas that need addressing. The first one is the distribution of the remaining work. So there is an argument in the sense that we are back to where John Maynard Keynes was several decades ago about, you know, the need to work longer hours or fewer hours. So there might be a question about distributing the remaining work more evenly amongst the population and allowing for more free time, which is basically something that, for instance, the German labor market studies tell you that this is what a lot of people want. The second would be, especially if you want to prepare for the kind of augmentation role of humans to technology, that the educational profiles need to change. So educational policy needs to prepare people much more in terms of adaptability. That, to me, means that they need to be better at creative and analytical skills rather than memorizing facts, where a lot of the educational system still seems to rely on. And the third one is really dealing with the social and as well as economic consequences of this inequality issue. Is this something that you would broadly see as the categories along which we would have to think, and what would you add?
Well, I think you're right, but I think this problem is an enormously challenging one, and I'm not sure there is a simple silver bullet solution. And, you know, picking up on some of the suggestions in particular, I think you're right that education needs to change in response to the kind of accelerating rate of technological change. But how in particular it should change, I think, is a much thornier issue. So you've highlighted that perhaps our schooling system should emphasize more creativity and less emphasis upon memorizing facts. But there is a question first about how you might do that and exactly what kind of creativity should be instilled. If we take the example of one of the occupations that's emerged that I mentioned earlier, data scientists, I think actually to be quite creative as a data scientist, you need to have at your fingertips, kind of imprinted upon your brain, quite a just a large mass of mathematical and statistical facts. And, you know, I'm not really clear that you can be creative in that occupation without at some point having rote learnt quite a, you know, large amount of knowledge. And, you know, how that is best to be done, I'm not entirely sure. And if indeed that's the right type of creativity for 20 years hence, I'm not entirely sure. I think it's very difficult to foresee exactly what skills in particular the workforce of 20 years hence will need.
We're not at a detail level here yet. I mean, at the beginning, this is just trying to set out really the basically broad compartments in terms of policy thinking on this. So it's just basically, of course, this is very broad brush, but you have to categorize first before you can actually drill down into the details. I mean, in the distributional question, we have this debate that actually originated from Silicon Valley about the basic income and its impact on how it can prop up domestic demand in a situation where we have inequality that is going to run away even further. Now, it's just basically about categorizing the you know, policy areas we need to address and then look for individual solutions within.
And fair enough. And, you know, obviously I endorse that particular effort to categorize possible responses. I'm just concerned that even within these categories, it's not clear to me that there is something that can actively solve this problem, or that can solve the problem while being kind of politically acceptable. I mean, maybe my pessimism here is born out of, I mean, I'm an engineer at the end of the day. I'm not an economist. So, you know, the extent to which people are pointing to me as being, you know, somehow a source for these policy responses is to me already a sign of some sort of desperation.
Okay. Well, but if you take this away for a moment, your backdrop as an engineer, if you were a policymaker and there were no restrictions to, you know, what you could do, what would, you know, against the backdrop of the current knowledge of the subject, would your response be?
So the distributional question that you highlight, I think, is the most important one. With the best educational system in the world, I don't think we'll necessarily be able to upskill everyone to the point that they're able to fill these new jobs that are created. So then it really does become a question of ensuring that the wealth that is generated is shared equally amongst all members of society. How that's to be done, I'm not entirely sure. I think the universal basic income is one kind of exciting possibility, but my kind of background doesn't leave me best qualified to assess the relative merits of these different proposals.
Okay, well, Michael, thank you very much for joining us today on this highly relevant topic, and I'm sure it's not going to go away anytime soon.
Well, I hope not. It's an important one, and I hope there will continue to be a lot of discussion around it. So thank you very much for having me.
Okay, thank you. You've just listened to an episode of Social Europe Podcast. If you don't want to miss future episodes, please subscribe on iTunes or on Stitcher. Thank you very much.